to another episode of Bringing Design Closer, the podcast focused on discussing design's role in tackling complex societal issues. Our goal is to have conversations here that inspire and help move the dial forward for organizations to become more human-centered in their approach to solving complex business and societal problems. My name is Jerry Scullion, and I'm the founder of the Human Centered Design Network and the CEO of ThisIsDoing.com, home to many of the world's best design and change-making courses online. Today in the show, we have Brigitte Metzler, Research Ops Lead at Australian Department of Agriculture, Water and Environment. And Brigitte is co-chair of the Research Ops community and is based in one of my favorite places on earth, Tasmania. And we cover off some of the eight pillars of research operations in this episode and talk openly about the challenges that Brigitte faced when setting up the architecture for Research Ops to blossom inside the Department of Agriculture, Water and Environment. We speak about the measurements of success for Research Ops and also the challenges that are faced when presenting it first to the organization, although in Brigitte's case, the maturity and the desire was already existing in her current role. We speak about the recent diagnosis that Brigitte have about being neurodiverse and her journey to get to that point. And I was really curious to tap more into this, and we cover off some interesting areas of symmetry whilst doing it. Now, before we jump in, Brigitte wanted to mention the Research Ops conference that is happening on June the 8th in New York. That's also available if you're remote. I'll throw a link to this in the show notes, but it's definitely something to get behind if you're interested in the whole area of Research Ops. Let's get into the episode. It's a brilliant one. Brigitte, it gives me the biggest satisfaction to finally welcome you onto This Is HD. I'm a huge fan and a very warm welcome to Bringing Design Closer. I'm delighted to have you on the show. So, Brigitte, tell us a little bit about you. So, where are you coming from today?
It's a good question, and thank you so much. Just equally such a fan. So, really honoured to be here with you and having a chat. So, thank you for that. I am right now in Tasmania. Australia. So it's a little teeny tiny island at the bottom of
beautiful
the world.
Beautiful island though.
It is absolutely a beautiful island. Yes.
When we were back and forth, I was like, Tasmania was the place that when I visited, I was like, Oh, this feels like home. Mm. And it's just, it's so like Ireland in many ways, especially where I grew up.
Right.
And when I visited there, it is probably one of the most beautiful places I've ever been.
It's
so
phenomenal.
You're very lucky.
I am, yes.
Yeah, and great food and great wine.
I know, we've got truffles and wine and olives and, you name it, we've got
it. If you were to design a country or a little island, it would probably be Tasmania that has all the
probably,
best stuff.
Yes, it does. Jeez, we've got amazing beaches and, we've got the East Coast, which is a little bit like Greece in the summer when it's really warm, sort of turquoise aqua water and white sands. And then you go over to the other side of Tasmania and it's these huge mountains and these deep rivers that, are just so untouched and beautiful.
Absolutely.
I just can't believe it. Very lucky. I mean,
Australia really is. It's got so many different terrains and so many different aspects to it, which is what makes it such a special place. Like, a special place in my heart, obviously, from living there for 13 and a half years. But I want to talk to you a little bit more. There's so many things we can speak about in this episode today. We've just been catching up and talking about your work in the Department of Agriculture in Australia.
Yes.
But maybe I'm going to start right back at the start and I'm going to ask you a question about whenever you're out and about, how do you describe or how do you answer the question when people say, what do you do?
My job title is Research Operations Lead at Department of Agriculture, Water and Environment. Most people don't know what that is. And so if I'm talking to just a random person on the street, my doctor, my physio or something, I'll say, well, my job is to take care of researchers, lots and lots and lots of them, all doing lots and lots of things, make sure that they have everything they need to do good work, and then we need to make sure that we can make the most of that work over time. That's pretty much how I
That's a pretty nice summary. nice summary.
Yeah.
So the work that you're doing with Department of Agriculture,
it's
Water and Environment, we call it DOAR, it's a great acronym.
It is.
But You mentioned there about like looking after many researchers. Mm-hmm. How many researchers are currently in DOOR?
It's a good question. And actually, So the interesting thing about DOOR, because it's so scientific, is that one in seven people in that department are actually a researcher.
Right.
But they're not user researchers.
Right.
They're scientists, and like we have a whole social sciences division, academic kind of research. So there's a deep understanding of what research is for, which is great. Mm-hmm. But when I got there, we had three teams who had been doing user research that I knew of for a little while, just little teams of two or three. And then we had this emerging large program, which is designed there to deliver on the department's trade reform agenda. And so we had one researcher, and wow. Now in our guild, I think I counted yesterday, I saw on our guild we've got 52 researchers and designers. Okay. And so that was last March, and now it's February. And here we are. So I think it's 34 delivery teams maybe, and several more on top of that. So we're just sitting on about 40 teams, I think, overall across the department that I need to take care
teams.
Of. Yeah.
That's a lot of different requirements and a lot of people working at probably different levels of maturity as regards research. In your role for DOOR, How do you work across all of those? So, like, obviously, we could speak a little bit more about research operations, because a lot of the benefits of being co-chair of the research operations can probably offer you some advantages in this.
Yeah.
So, how does that work in terms of managing those?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, we just became a team of three, so that's yay, that's good. You're quite right. I mean, so I have been lucky enough to be taking care of the research operations community since sort of the beginning of 2019, more or less, after Kate Towsey, who founded the community, left. And there's a cheese board, and Holly Cole and myself are co-chairs. And all of the projects that we've done have really defined the profession of research operations. And so it's probably the first time in my life I've ever actually done a job and people sort of say to me, are you the right person to ask this question? And I have all of these frameworks. I have one printed right beside me on my on my wall, which tells me exactly what my job is. And so I primarily work across the eight pillars of user research.
Yeah.
So that's an article that Emma Bolton wrote up, which actually it's a beautiful thing, because it's, we're all come from research, so we love our raw data. And so we did, in the research ops community, we did a project called What is Research Operations? So when Kate founded the community, we got together and went, we probably need to figure this thing out. So we did a project across 17 countries. We did 33 workshops. And then I was lucky enough to do the global analysis and put that all together. And all of that raw data is still actually available online. You can have a look at it and pull through it and make sense of it.
Yeah.
And when we did that, we put together the What is Research Operations sort of diagram. And that tells you the what of ops. So those are all the tasks, and those are the questions people ask me all the time, the what of ops. And then the eight pillars is how does research connect with operations? Where does that fit? And so that's a lot more strategic.
Can we talk a bit more around that? Was Emma Bolton wrote that, didn't they?
Yeah, she did.
Years ago.
Yeah, so just to give due credit and all of that where it's
Absolutely.
Due. So Emma Bolton, Tomomi Sasaki, Holly Cole, and I got together to just have a look at the original, the flower diagram that we have of what research operations is, to try to see if we could make sense of the data in a different way to help communicate the story. And Emma ultimately came up with the eight pillars, but it's actually it's very robust, because I think, and I don't think we did that on purpose, but there's actually, like in business management, there are things called PESL models. And a PESL model is actually a business strategy model. And so that looks at the people, the environment. I can't remember the rest of PESL, but you can probably Google it.
Processes in there. Yeah.
Yeah, and then there's legal and anyway. So
there's things in there.
Yeah, there's things. Trust me, just go Google it. And when you look at the eight pillars of user research, it equates quite well. And it has not failed me in, 4 years. I still use it every day. I write my week notes according to the structure. All of my, DevOps boards and my tickets are all, is this a governance question? Is it a data and knowledge management question? Is it a research recruitment question? Is it a tooling question? What do we need to do here? And and that helps to frame.
So what is
a
day? It sounds like there's an awful lot going on here.
Yeah.
Now, what does a typical day look like for you then, as regards your work?
Most people comment, gosh, you've got a lot of meetings. Your calendar's very full.
A lot of Zoom calls.
Yes. And, as I say, we're all online and the team's distributed. And so, of course, it's all, all on Teams. I have a research operations stand up and actually we have a digital trade handbook. So you can actually have a look at how do we gather? You can go and actually have a look at that. That's online and visible. Yeah. So I have our stand-ups. I have a capability team stand-up, which is all of the disciplines getting together, the leads from each discipline, so design, content, research ops, and legal and security, getting together to discuss the disciplines and how we work that stuff together. Yeah, so we do that, and then usually we'll head into some kind of a meeting with someone who has a question from anywhere in the department. And people will be messaging, of course, to say, I need access to this tool, or do I need consent for this, or what does consent look like when I'm doing this type of research method? And so, at first it was having to manually answer all of those things, and now, of course, I can refer people to, have you gone and had a look at the handbook? Have you, found the template, the tool, the guide? Here's the how-to. If you want a tooling request, then you send that through to the research operations inbox and that'll get picked up by my team.
Sure.
Yeah.
So
there you go.
In a life before research ops, I know there's people out there who are probably like kind of going, research ops, okay. Mm-hmm. They might have heard of DevOps and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But what does life look like? Can you remember what life looked like as a researcher without research ops? Can we talk a little bit more on that? Because I think it might paint a picture of familiarity to some people.
Yeah, I think it does. And, when we do a talk about what research ops is or the eight pillars of user research, you just see all of the researchers in a room and you see their shoulders are all tight and then you tell them about it and there's this deep sigh and everyone lets go. Someone understands. So I think that a lot of the work, so operations work, a lot of it is something I'm quite passionate about because I'm passionate about making explicit hidden work. And so, if you're a researcher without research operations, you're doing it anyway. I guarantee it.
Yeah.
You cannot not be doing it. What you're doing, though, is probably feeling really nervous and stressed and flying by the seat of your pants and hoping for the best and crossing your fingers a lot of the time, to be really honest, because all of the doing of research is almost this tiny thing, and there's the planning, there's creating the environment for research to happen. You've got to get buy-in. You've got to have people understand why am I doing this piece of research and why should I be on board with you going and investigating this thing and having a look at it and pulling apart this thing that really feels like mine? If you're in a research team that is separate to the thing, that's quite a bit of the work. You've got to, find what the right process and method is. You've got to write your consent form, and I have zero doubt that every single person is writing a consent form and then going, oh, surely it's a better way, getting that checked off by legals, and you know, it just goes on
repeating
and on.
The same processes over and over again.
Yeah, and then having people call you, which is certainly, you know, when I started Research Operations, I was sort of brought in by a team to look at data, but quickly could see that actually what they had was a data and knowledge management issue. They didn't want me to do their analysis. They wanted me to help them find their data, make sense of the data, feel safe with the data, know how to share it, give them a mechanism for sharing. Like, you know, as a researcher, I'm sure everyone will have experienced someone calling them and saying, have you done any research on XYZ? And you're like, oh, I'm sure I did. Well, first of all, can I find it? And then second of all, should I be sharing this with them?
Yeah.
If you're in a big organization, should I? I don't know. That's the silo
absolutely
over there. And, yeah.
Yeah, is there stuff on there that can incriminate people? And is there personal data? Has it been de-anonymized?
Yeah, I was going to say we haven't even talked about participant safety, you know, so it just goes on. There's a lot.
Absolutely.
And so I don't know how researchers have the mental space to make, like, you know, I'm doing a PhD and my supervisors are really big on the idea of doing nothing for a while in order to actually have proper thought about the data. Like, go for a walk. Have some space.
After research, just do nothing. Is that what you're talking about? Yeah, you're referring to?
Yeah.
I'm a big believer in that as well, just letting it sit. And just letting your brain process it, especially in the online world where it becomes amplified and concentrated in that experience of when you're listening and deep listening. It's interesting to see that. In their theory, how long? Do they have any theories on how long? Are they that specific?
I don't know. I'm doing my PhD part-time and I hope that they think it's very long.
3 years. I waited in between 3 years to synthesize that data.
Well, you know, I did have some new insights about it only recently, and some of the data I started collecting in, I don't know, when did I start collecting it? Maybe it was 2017 even.
Right.
Yeah. You know, I've been going sort of longitudinally, so it's been going for a while. But
you're picking up lots of data as you go along.
Yeah, of course. And also
absolutely
learning new, you're becoming a different person. And so I'm not saying that, you know, design researchers or user researchers should have years of space to do their research. It's probably a bit, there's a tension there because you're always working within a capitalist society, and I think it's just there and it needs to be wrestled with. But I think if I could create time and space for researchers, I would feel that I had done a good job for them.
And their safety as well. That's obviously a huge part of it.
Yeah.
When we were speaking earlier on, we were talking a little bit more around the architecture.
Mm-hmm.
And instantly I was like, okay, this is a fascinating topic. And I know listeners will be, you know, the ears will prick up a little bit more when we start talking about this. But you joined the door 9 months ago, and you mentioned about setting up the architecture for the organization. Can you talk
for user research,
For user research, Can you walk me through the stages right at that moment where you were walking into the organization? What did that look like? What were you faced with? And what were the challenges that you were faced with at the start?
Okay. I'm going to have to do this in two stages because I really want to talk to you about the philosophy of how you create architecture, but we'll talk about that in a bit. So when I got to Door, user research had been around for about 4 years, just in little pockets.
Okay.
I think about four. And so it was generally not done by people who were already working within the department. It was done by people who came in to do a piece of work. And so there was nothing in relation to, okay, I've got this piece of personally identifiable information. Where should I store it? What does
the
consent
form? Can I ask where they were storing it then? What did it look like in terms of data storage at that point?
So generally what's happening is just absolute rigidity, which is fantastic because, you know, if you're not sure what to do, you should always de-identify. So de-identified data, nothing else kept. So we've worked with the legal team for the past 9-10 months and with the teams who were already there to say, what does it look like when we're doing that better, or what does it look like if we're wanting to do this in a systemic, organized way where we're bringing everything together kind of thing? What, you know, it is in government you have a thing called the Archives Act, which is a piece of legislation that defines how you should store a piece of information. And what does that look like when you're doing service design delivery, which is incredibly movable? You know, at what point has a decision been made and therefore it needs to be recorded as a record? And and how do you create that in a space that is constantly moving? So, you know, we've really had to sort of work together to understand knowledge management, but then also how that knowledge changes over time. And that's a thing I really like. I'm very interested in that. So I think we can work. I'm looking forward to working on that a lot more.
Over the next while. So at that point, you said there was research, user research that had been going on for a number of years.
Mm-hmm.
When you walked into the organization, there was probably lots of other challenges at play. But what did you do to move the dial forward in terms of implementation of research ops at a mindset level?
Yeah,
I'm sure you had to sell still this thing into stakeholders.
Well, I think I was just really very lucky. So that sales pitch had already been done by senior leaders in the organization. They brought me in on purpose because they believed in research operations. They knew it was what they needed. They knew that they wanted to bring in this way of working and, you know, to sort of deliver on a future vision for the department, they would need to embrace human-centered design. They would need to then grapple with how do we operationalize that for the entire department. So my lovely boss, Magda, one of the senior researchers there, Helen, had said, this is what we need. We need to be able to find our research. We need to know if it's good. We need to be able to actually keep the data somehow and understand if we should use it again or not. These are all of our pain points we need to, and we're going to need to grapple this because we are about to go through a period of massive change in the Ag 2030 trade reform agenda, and then we're looking at, you know, biosecurity reform and imports reform as well. So we knew all of this stuff had to happen in the next couple of years. So they kind of brought me in ahead of time, which was nice.
What does it look like? I'm sure. And like, I just want to preface, like, you know, you mentioned about landing this role, you know, people had seen a video that you'd done in your previous role. That led to this role opening up for you. And I think that's a really interesting segue about encouraging designers to talk about their work and to share and to be more transparent. And at its core, my understanding of the research ops team is that's one of the underpinning mindsets, isn't it? Or am I right in saying that? About being able to share and be hyper-transparent about what you're doing and why you're doing it.
So several things there that spring to mind. One is that if you are going to be a research operations person, right now in particular, what you're doing is a change role. So your job is to break down silos and to make people feel safe when you do it. So it's a really hard job. So it's definitely not for the faint of heart. But, you know, ultimately, when you go to work, you generally have a sense of purpose and meaning in your work, right? Mm-hmm. And so no one puts a barrier in place necessarily on purpose. They do it as a protective mechanism, I think, in general, or because, you know, when you've got a large organization, how on earth do you manage all that knowledge and information and people yeah. and the busyness of it? So it's not an intentional thing. And so one of the beautiful things about governance, I personally say that governance sets you free. It's really, really daggy.
Liberates you.
It's very liberative, because if that's the right word or way to say it. But if you can make implicit stuff explicit, then it sets a foundation for people to feel like they know exactly what they are and are not allowed to do. And they also have a sense of agency in the decisions that are being made about how those silos get broken down, when, with whom, and how. So, I think that's the key thing that we do throughout the whole research life cycles. So if you look at how do we get consent? It's not just the participant, although they're really important. Obviously, they have their own sense of agency and ownership of their story. The researcher has a sense of agency and ownership of the context of the story. They're kind of, they're the midwife that's taking a whole bunch of stories and kind of making sense of them and funneling them out in a way that makes sense to someone else. And that contextual translation is super important to researchers. So you have to, you've got to hold on to that. Then the people who actually kind of are responsible for delivering the thing, they have to have a sense of ownership and purpose and safety about how that stuff gets shared, with whom and when and how.
It's, I'm sure at that time when you were in the early stages of your role, measuring success for the research apps, hopefully this isn't a contentious area, but how do you measure success through implementation of research apps?
I think it's a good question to ask. I think I don't know that I've got it right, and so I guess I would preface it with
these are
my
way. So
there's a couple of things.
The Metzler method.
Yeah. That's right. So this is my second time, and what I've noticed about research operations is that you are doing hidden work. So as I said before, so you're doing hidden work. So if it's good, it should be unnoticeable. And so that makes it really hard to show that it's good. I see that everywhere. You know, when people have the right tools for the job, they don't stop to think, someone got me the right tool for the job. Someone went through the procurement process and the, you know, privacy and the cyber and all of that stuff to make sure it was right. Yeah. It just happens. So that is about talking frequently and often about this is what we got done. So in my previous role, I learnt to do that because people would say, who are you and what is it that you're doing? Because research operations wasn't even a term then. We really did have to explain ourselves. Here I do that in a number of ways. One is, you know, across so many teams, you can, I imagine as a researcher, I would be sending Bridget a message and saying, can you answer my question? And then she's not responding to me and I don't know why. And it's because you probably don't realize that, you know, maybe 30 people have asked me a question at the same time or something like that.
Yeah.
So we have an internal a research ops roundup. And it started out as an email to just various people to go, hey, this is kind of what we covered off this week so that you can see what we're doing. And then has become like a digital newsletter that people can subscribe to, and so they can see these are the things that we're doing. And then just recently we started out an open Kanban, so literally anyone in the department can put in a ticket now, which is a bit scary, But at the same time, it also means that anyone in the department can see exactly what we're working on at any moment if they want to. And then finally, because I work with leaders who are really into working in the open and transparently, mm-hmm. I'm expected to write about that in public as well. So I have week notes and I ramble on at length because I usually write them really late at night.
Yeah, absolutely.
You can see that on Medium. So there you go.
The week notes thing is really interesting. I've seen lots of people over the last, 18 months, maybe 2 years, it's become a thing that, you know, Saturday morning, you know, I'll get 30 seconds in between feeding the kids.
Yeah.
And I look on my LinkedIn and I'll see people's week notes. Where did it come from? Is that part of the research ops community?
No, I think it actually originated at GDS in the UK.
Okay.
That's my guesstimate.
That would make sense.
Jordan Hatch, yeah, he comes from, he worked at GDS and he week notes. Lots of people in One Team Gov, which is a group of public servants from all over the world who in their spare time, unpaid time, get together to talk about government and being a public servant. They do week notes and I think it's just about how do you support democracy and a sense of trust in government. You know, we're just people. And we're just doing our best.
They're showing transparency in what mm-hmm. they're doing and what they're achieving on a week-by-week basis.
Which is
a mind shift.
It is. And I think it's so important for research operations as well because it's not all sunshine and roses and you don't get that story very often. But my leaders have empowered me to do this. Mm. It's not sunshine and roses. This was hard this week.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I noticed when I was researching for the episode that as part of research ops, recruitment is a big thing.
Mm.
And is it one of the pillars? I'm not sure if it's one of the pillars,
yeah,
but
it is. Yeah,
it is one of the pillars. So what does that look like? Recruitment in terms of bringing new people into the team, or is it recruitment of participants? Mm. How do you frame it?
It's recruitment of participants. Yeah, it's a tricky one because when you're in a scaling organization, you're also doing lots of recruitment. So it can be hard. So recruitment of research participants is a definite pain point across everyone in user research. I think it's a very rare researcher who doesn't feel a pain. And there's just so much to it. I mean, how do you can dig right into it. Like how do you create safety for research participants? How do you actually transform it from, you know, an extractive process of gathering story to a co-design process that I'm sure that there's a movement there that will happen. But of course, you know, user research is kind of embedded in it depends on which discipline you come from, but in mine it sort of comes from anthropology and ethnography, and it can be seen as an extractive process. I mean, there's a lot of deeply uncomfortable stuff about anthropology where you're really looking at that kind of paternalistic approach to understanding people and so how do you actually create a much more equal, ethical, unbiased research project? You've got to start with ethical, unbiased, you know, research participants, and you've got to be ethical with them, and you've got to get lots and lots of different diversity across that. So
and surely as part of your team as well, that's one of the prerequisites, mm-hmm. that you have a diverse and inclusive team, and that's not just with, you know, gender and race and everything else.
Yeah.
It's in terms of different, you know, neurodiversity. We were speaking earlier about neurodiversity, and you mentioned that, you know, you've been diagnosed a number of years ago as neurodiverse. Are you okay to talk a little bit more around, you know, why it's important to have representation for neurodiverse people as part of the research team? Because for me, it feels like something that it probably doesn't get spoken enough about generally across the board, but specifically for people who are synthesizing complex data and being able to bring that perspective in is hugely powerful and just ultimately required. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think actually, I suspect a lot of the research community is quite neurodiverse in any case. That's my guesstimation, but certainly, so if you look at, so first of all, just to make it really explicit and really clear, being neurodiverse is not a mental health issue. But that's another factor of that stuff as well. And so, first of all, when you bring in a person who is neurodiverse, they'll come with different skills. So I have ADHD. That means, according to my psychologist, that means I'm really good at going incredibly deep into the data, really fine detail, and then going all the way back up right to the top and understanding a lot of connections that other people are not going to see. So I'm really good at seeing stuff that you wouldn't normally see, but also equally comfortable to just dive straight down into, you know, fine-grained data. So that's really great. When you look at, so I used to have a researcher in my previous team who had dyslexia. How do you create, how do you do good operations for someone who is dyslexic? So for a dyslexic person, you might be looking at, well, this researcher is not going to be their best selves if they're stuck writing up reports all the time.
Yeah.
If you could speech to text that, that's going to be beautiful. And in fact, what we often did was she would tell the story, and just because that happened to be the stage of our scaling, I would sit down and type it up for her. She would just tell me the story. It was fabulous. And then, you know, I would do that. Obviously, later on, we moved to speech to text and those kinds of things. How do you, if you're doing building a user research library and you've got a whole bunch of sketch notes, how do you then serve that to a person who is trying to use the research or read and understand the research who is blind?
Okay.
That's not going to work. So
yeah.
In a really very meta way, research operations is also about designing and running a product team. You're designing and building several products, so you need to do your user research, go through the design process, make sure that you're building something that is accessible to lots of different, you know, accessibility needs, and make sure that people can actually use the thing. So, there's heaps of user research in research ops.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And like, you know, when you were speaking there earlier about, you know, being able to drill down into the sort of the macro or the minutia, and then zooming all the way back out, that's a huge thing within service design as well, to be able to look right down to the interface level and then come all the way back out and understand the context of, you know, various levels of Zoom and whatever it is you're working on. And it's probably something that, you know, that whole kind of ADHD is probably an attribute across lots of disciplines within design.
Yeah.
I think so. Can I ask, and hopefully it's not too personal, how did you go about getting diagnosed? What's the steps going on that? Because a lot of people probably sitting there driving their car listening, kind of going, that sounds very familiar to me. And like, you know, I'd love to know what the steps are around that, if you're okay to talk about it.
Yeah, sure. Well, and I think it is important to talk about it. I wasn't diagnosed until I was, what was I, 45?
Something. Don't tell your age. you were something.
I was definitely an adult. I'm not going to be ashamed of my age. Definitely an adult. And as a cishet female, very female person, ADHD is just not something, like, I actually had to go and find someone who would see me. So I tried when I was 40. I went to see someone and she said, well, you know, you seem okay. You're doing really well in your career. I mean, why would you be doing this? I said, well, you know, regardless of the outcome, I feel as though I'm missing some tools in my toolbox, and it would be really great to have some more tools to manage some stuff. And I can see there are barriers emerging in my career, and it's, I know it's because I'm neurodiverse.
Yeah.
And and unfortunately that definitely turned out to be true. And I just happened to, I've got two children, and one of them I suspected was neurodiverse. And so in the end, it was a process of I had found an ADHD a clinic here on the island, and they specialized in families with neurodiverse families. And and so we decided to start with me, so that everyone else could get used to the idea of neurodiversity, which was very uncomfortable, while I went through my little process. And then we've been going on that process for my son as well.
So is that person a psychologist, or is it an occupational therapist? Or what kind of person is that?
Yeah, it's a complex system in Australia. Mm. So I saw a psychologist who went through a process of diagnosis but can't actually make the diagnosis. So then you have to go and see a psychiatrist who formally makes the diagnosis. And then, you can decide if you're, so the psychologist is about giving you tools in your toolbox. And then the psychiatrist is, this is your formal diagnosis and, would you like medication and that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So that's the process. And there is one psychiatrist on my island who will see an adult female and make a diagnosis.
Yeah, it is. It's such a, hopefully I'm not saying this wrong, but it's such a new thing, really. But it is for me anyway, in my mindset. It seems to be a lot more prevalent over the last decade anyway. But we were talking earlier about me growing up in Ireland in early 80s, mid 80s, whatever it was. Yeah. And I'm sure there was loads of people in my school that, weren't diagnosed with this. And, potentially are, you know, have gone through life with some sort of level of difficulty because of that lack of understanding of how to actually work with them.
Yeah.
So I think it's an important topic to speak about, because there's people in my generation that are probably experiencing some of the things that you were going through. And
you go to, I think it's been, I'm just so grateful to finally have a diagnosis, and there are so many reasons why I finally stopped feeling guilty for being myself. I was thinking I'm not trying hard enough, or maybe I'm just not a nice person, maybe I'm no good, all of that kind of, you beat yourself up over and over and over again, and that's really damaging. But to actually just finally kind of, I am on medication for ADHD, and the day that I took it, I was really scared about it. And my husband said, look, if you don't have ADHD, you're going to clean the house really well. You're going to run around the house and clean it really, really well. It's like, that's the worst thing that's going to happen here. So it's fine. I'm here with you and we can just do this together. And, I was terrified, really. I took it, and suddenly I just, I noticed that time changed for me. So, time blindness is a thing with ADHD. And I thought it was just because I was a bad person, that I was always late. But actually, time is actually just different for people who are not neurodiverse and don't have ADHD. And I instantly knew that was the first thing I noticed.
Wow.
Amazing.
That's actually quite trippy. Do you know what I mean? Like, because, it's kind of ingrained. It's ingrained in me, time is always something that I'm looking at and I'm aware of. And it's something that I'm, it's there. And for that to not be a thing is huge. So what kind of change happened after?
Look,
did you buy a watch?
I don't know. No. And I still struggle. I'm still late a lot of the time for things, but you know, I noticed that my brain wasn't constantly
low
on dopamine. So I wasn't constantly looking at my phone and checking messages. And, you know, right. I could actually just settle and finish a thing. And, you know, so that day I just sat down and finished something I'd been working on for 3 months.
Wow. Went,
okay. I can finish
that is
things.
Incredible. That is, that's so cool. Like, you know, in many ways.
Yeah.
You know, so.
Yeah. And you know, ultimately as well, you know, someone had asked me to do something. And so with ADHD, you get this thing called rejection sensitivity dysphoria, which is, you know you're a bit weird. And so, and you're always seeking that kind of approval so that you get that dopamine input. And that's, you know, one of the ways, you know, I'm a real helper. People will say that to me, you're so kind, and you just always say yes. And you know, you should probably stop doing that because you're going to run yourself to the ground. And you know, shortly after I had started that, someone asked me to do something that was a little bit unreasonable. And I said, look, you know, it's a close friend. And I said, look, I love you, but I love me more. And so I'm just going to say no, thank you. And
right.
I could never have done that before.
It's very powerful in terms of going through that whole kind of diagnosis process to, it's almost like the governance piece that you mentioned earlier. It's liberating.
It's set me free.
In many ways.
Yeah.
So I can see why now the likes of research ops, it kind of feels like it's part of you. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think so.
Part of your fabric.
Yeah, I had no idea that, you know, there's all these different ways. Like, you know, I've done so many different jobs. I've been a trainer. I've done data analysis. I did metadata management. I've done knowledge management. I've done business management. You know, all of those things that are necessary for research operations. And I've done research. And you put them all together and you actually just get research operations.
Absolutely.
It's like the whole thing was made for me.
Absolutely. And it's who you are. And a lot of the work that you've done kind of point back to the strength of your neurodiversity. I mean, that's a lot of the benefits.
Yeah.
You've created a lot of these systems that a lot of people are reaping the rewards for. So the research ops community, obviously there's lots of people as part of the research ops community.
It's not me. So, team effort.
Absolutely, but it just seems like it's an extension of yourself when you relay back to your diagnosis and the journey that you've been on.
Mm.
So, like, kudos to you for going through that whole process. And
Thank you.
You know, it's fantastic that you're able to talk about it, and hopefully people out there listening will have a little bit more of an understanding of what it means. And I know I've learned a few things today from speaking with you, which is really good.
You know, it's definitely not all bad.
Absolutely. But look, we could honestly speak about lots of different areas. And, you know, I'd love to have you back on the show at some point to catch up about how things are going with you. So if people wanted to reach out to you or connect with you, what's the best way for people to do that?
Okay. Well, first of all, I would say... if you don't want to connect with me, but you want to connect with research operations, I would probably go to the website, which is researchops.community. Nice and easy.
Yeah.
There's a little join the community button at the bottom
join
of
the Slack
first page.
Yeah. As well.
Join the Slack group. And then I'm always on Twitter. You know, neurodiverse people quite like Twitter. It's very quick and immediate.
quick
I'm quite often there. I'm on LinkedIn. What else? I don't know. Can't think.
I'll put links to those in the show notes anyway, and people can reach out to you there, and they can tweet to you whenever they want.
Sounds
Bridget
good.
Is absolutely brilliant speaking with you. Have a great one, and thanks very much for giving us
thank
all
you.
Your energy today.
Thank you. Likewise. Nice to speak to you from another island.
Another island to another island.
Yeah.
Take care.
Thanks.
So there you have it. That's all for this episode of Bringing Design Closer. If you like this episode, feel free to visit thisis8cd.com, where you can access our back catalogue of over 100 episodes, with episodes related to service design, product management, design research, and much, much more. If you're interested in design and innovation training, feel free to check out our business, thisisdoing.com, where you can join online classrooms and learn from the world's best design and innovation leaders. Join the This Is HCD newsletter, where you'll receive updates from the network. And also, if you're interested, apply to join the Slack community on thisishcd.com. Stay safe, and until next time, take care.